This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good evening, everyone. And welcome to Art and Science, Science and Art. We have an oversold or an overgiven away crowd tonight. Great to see everyone here, and I think you're in for a real treat. The treat begins by our being blessed with the presence of Des Makanoff, who is somehow making time between frenetic working on this amazing new play. And very excited. I saw it Friday night, and it was a well-deserved, enthusiastic standing ovation, which I hear we've had most every night. And I know, Des, you have limited time, so as moderator, Dan Einhorn, it's the only time I will have any control over Des Makanoff's actions in the next. So, 10 minutes or so?
10 minutes. You kick me, though.
I won't kick you.
Please do.
I can do 30 seconds, and I tend to do, an hour and a half. 10 minutes, I don't know. I'll do my best. I'm so sorry. I actually have Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips here from Oklahoma City. And he's only with me for this next, between now and 7 o'clock. He just saw the matinee, and I really do need to go and get notes from him or a conversation going. So I'm sorry, or I would stay for all of this. So I apologize in advance. We had to stop the show this afternoon because of a technical problem. I feel like I'm doing a lot of apologizing. But I came across this quote, "The arts and sciences, essential to the prosperity of the state and to the ornament of human life, have a primary claim to the encouragement of every lover of his country and mankind." It's not Barack Obama. It's not Karl Marx. That's George Washington. So it seems to me that the conversation you're going to have today goes back to the roots of this great union. And I think there is a natural bond between art and science. So I'm going to do three very quick paragraphs hope to make some feeble contribution to the rest of the discussion. First of all, in the theater, we tend to be quite conservative about technology and, for that matter, science. With wireless microphones, one still gets an awful lot of complaining that we would be better off like the opera, not using any reinforcement at all. I think, though, if you parachuted back to 1949 and sat in a theater and heard the orchestrations and even listened to the great Ethel Merman, who needed no amplification, I think you would find it a very odd experience, because theater, in fact, exists on the shifting sands of time. It happens in the moment. We practice our craft in the eternal present. And so we actually do need to keep up with the technologies that our audiences become used to. And this started way back in Athens. The reason, and it has a direct correlation and impact on dramatic literature. You know, the reason we have these great speeches by Aeschylus and Euripides and Sophocles back in the classical age in Athens when these plays were written, of course, they had these huge audiences. You know, that original theater was actually wooden and rectangular. The stone amphitheater came a couple of generations later. But that affected, of course, the style of the theater. That's the reason we had the multiple voices of the chorus to fill these. If anyone's been to Apollodorus, which will seat 16,000 people, so of course there's a relationship. Just fast forward to Shakespeare's time. Now Shakespeare started off, of course, proving himself as a poet, the upstart crow. He hadn't gone to Oxbridge. So they were suspicious of him. So at first, his early plays, he's drunk on words. And they're a little bit declamatory. And you can picture him in the theater at that point was called, of course, the theater. And you can picture those plays with the actors hurling the words around. But their struggle was to get inside. They wanted to move the theater inside. So after they... You know, they carried that theater board by board across the river and made the globe. After that, they moved into the Blackfriars. And you'll notice in Shakespeare's later plays, psychology starts playing a greater role. You know, it's not as much about language. The language in The Tempest is very, very simple. But at the same time, he's employing masks. So we have Inigo Jones. Suddenly they can do all kinds of effects, and they're inside. They can use lighting. This, I think we've always had a relationship with technology and science in the theater. In the 30 years since I signed my first contract back in 1982, the theater has transformed tremendously. You know, we had no LED technology. There's an entire room on the second floor of the Playhouse that's dedicated to a whole series of offices. That was all lighting racks when I was first here. We just started with computerized boards. We had all, and that was all about saving, on labor. We were using the same old-fashioned instruments that they used in the 1950s. Now we have all these robotic lighting instruments and color changers, and you know it's a whole new world. And that's the palette that we work with. Those are our paints, and it comes directly from science. Two other just shorter paragraphs. One hopes, and he'll kick me if they're not. You know, one great collaboration we had here was with the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, a defense intellectual think tank that's here at UCSD. And we did a play, which some of you might have even seen, called A Walk in the Woods, which was about arms control. And it was a great play by Lee Blessing. But we got to interact with defense intellectuals and nuclear physicists. And in fact, our first performance was in front of 50, in the rehearsal room, I mean, defense intellectuals. And that's about as intimidated as I think I've ever felt. That was really scary. But, you know, we went on with that play to do it for, at the Library of Congress for the Senate. And we were told by Senator Sam Nunn that actually changed votes on the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. This was about, of course, this was inspired by the walks in the woods between Paul Nitze and Kvitsinski several years before this, where they had actually hammered out their own arms agreement and tried to sell it to their two countries. Very, very inspiring work. We relied very heavily on the sciences. In Yoshimi was an interesting creative process, and I will just share it very briefly. The Flaming Lips approached me and said, would you make a play out of Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots? And I listened to the music, and I said, well, sure, I'll give it a go. And we'd never really spent any time together. And I knew just a few things. I knew that there was a song that suggested a kind of love triangle on this album. And I knew that there was this story kind of implied where a robot sacrifices itself and starts feeling human emotion. And it suggested a kind of an anime plot, a kind of a science fiction plot. But it was a sketch. Good sketch, but a sketch, not a real story. And then the most important thing turned out to be something that happened to the band. And what happened to them is they lost a friend. She died in Japan, a Japanese friend, while they were recording this album. And that inspired them to write the song It's Summertime. And they wrote it for her parents. And strangely enough, even though that had nothing directly to do with the album, I felt that their emotional journey and that the thematic content of the album had everything to do with this event. And so when I in the car, I think I got this from Irwin Jacobs. You know, it's good to be doing some good thinking in the car, and you might come up with a great idea. And so I started playing the music over and over again, and gradually the story that's on stage took shape. And then I went back to Wayne, and we started working on that together. He was enthusiastic about it. I think that as in the sciences, sometimes it's about making a kind of intuitive leap. You know, sometimes it's not just about facts and figures and research. And sometimes it's about, it comes from another plane. And you have to, of course, I think, be well-informed to have anything good happen to you that way. You have to work hard. You have to be diligent. But I think one of the things that we share in the arts and the sciences is we have a sense of collaboration. I think we share information, we share our thoughts, we support each other. I think that's absolutely true. And I also think that we require imagination and the ability to dream. And one thing that I hope you'll speak about a little bit is that it seems to me that we are joined together at the hip. When the sciences are not supported, the arts aren't supported either. And I think we have coming up in a couple of years the anniversary of the birth of the National Endowment for the Arts. It'll be its 50th anniversary. I, for one, would love to see the NEA step up to a new level. And I'd also like to see our country do far more in terms of supporting the sciences. We have so many, you know, deadly challenges ahead of us that it would behoove us all to make those intuitive leaps in really important matters. I'm going to leave you. I'm going to go to Wayne Coyne, and I hope you have a spirited discussion. Thanks.
Now, the bios of each of the panelists is in the program, so I'm not going to repeat them. I really want you to meet the incredible people behind those bios and to hear their stories. I was thinking as we're sitting here, we don't just have the best arts and science talent on this stage. We all are just minutes walk from our office, aren't we? Okay. I mean, people, that's how close we are. So it's really pretty amazing just what's going on right here. So I want to quickly let you know the names of the people, and then we'll come back. Each one individually. We have Christopher Ashley, our passionate, brilliant artistic director since 2007. Pamela is right here. Pamela Ifkin Ansari, who's a leading researcher from the Sanford Burnham. Skipped over Tom Albright, who's the professor and director of the Vision Center at the SOC, and he has some really amazing stories. I realize you can help vision by refracting lenses, but you can help vision even more by refracting the understanding of what vision is. Santiago Horrigan is professor-in-chief of UCSD's minimally invasive surgery program and a pioneer in bariatric surgery. And to my left, a man who creates life in the test tube, Dr. Jerry Joyce. So, Chris, I'd like to start with you, not just because you're the ruler of all that you see here, but because you are the perfect energy of activation. And so I'd love you to start.
Fantastic. I'd like to start by saying hello to the people on the sides. We're usually really attentive to sight lines here at the La Jolla Playhouse. But in this case, we're a little bit hemmed in by there's a set from one of the UCSD student productions with whom we share these spaces. They were kind enough to let us use the space for the night. So hello. We'll try to turn and say hello to you once in a while. This conversation feels very organic here at La Jolla Playhouse, and we think a lot about the fact that we're making art in the middle of a real hotbed of scientific and engineering innovation. I think what we do really rhymes with that work in the sciences, because what we do is really experimentation. Whether it's new plays, new musicals, or reconsidering more classic texts, we're really engaged in an iterative process of figuring out what the art wants to be and daring to fail in order to reconsider, rework, re-engineer, rewrite, restage, and hopefully end up having an even bigger success. Dan was just talking about the process of experimentation over at Yoshimi. I think some of you have seen it already. It's a piece I'm incredibly excited about, and it really embodies a lot of the things that I think we're going to talk about today. It's tremendously adventurous and innovative technologically. It's very much about sort of science, creativity, and the imagination. And because it is so complicated, we've of the six performances we've had so far, only two have managed to run without a pretty significant stop. So really what we're asking our audiences to do, especially in these early previews, is to be able to tolerate watching us experiment. I've been amazed by the kind of great goodwill that the audiences bring to that process. And I think some of it is because they live in a world and a city where the process of experimentation is exciting, and the tolerance for failure to get to success is really, really high. I think you might not know, as a not theater professional, which many of you are not in the audience, how long the process on some of these shows is. The Flaming Lips, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, began as a kind of, the conversation that Des was talking about was, I think, 7 years ago. And I would say that's pretty fast for a new musical to come into existence. We did Memphis here, which then went on to some success on Broadway, and that was about 10 years of development before it premiered here. So really for new musicals, there's so many factors to get right. There's so many things that have to kind of come together harmoniously and excitingly that often that is a 10-year process. And having the patience to stick with it and having a couple central creators who have the investment and the vision and say, like, I know that there's a great piece here, despite the fact that I'm going to hit all of the obstacles along the way, is really the key central ingredient to making a new musical happen. I would say also theater is a truly collaborative art form, you never know who the great idea is going to come from, and it is not always the director. I had a kind of amazing experience on Memphis. In the second act, there was a point that we just couldn't get right. It was a kind of the love scene between a white guy and a black woman, and it kept feeling kind of flaccid and not dangerous enough. And we hadn't fixed it, and we were about a week out from opening on Broadway. And I was standing in the back and looking at the scene and saying, what's wrong with this? Where is the edge? Where is the surprise in it? And an usher was standing next to me, a black woman, and she said, this scene's no good. And I turned to her, and I said, wow, why? Because I really wanted to know. And she said, I hate him. She's talking about the white character. I said, why? And she said, well, does he think he's black? And he was like sort of being a big crusader. And she was so resented that he was sort of taking on for the black character all of this kind of political energy. And that went in, and I went to talk to the writer. And the next day, the big pivot turned into him saying, when did I get blacker than you, to the black character. And they had a real crisis in their relationship over the politics of black and white relationship, which completely was an idea that came from the usher. So you really in theater can never know where the intuitive leap that Des was talking about is coming from. And I think being willing to open yourself up to it really is collaborative, and ownership of ideas, while sometimes incredibly important to us, ultimately isn't the central thing. The central thing is that good ideas can come from unexpected places. I think that's all I want to say to begin.
Okay, great. Thank you. Pam, in deference, I want to bring you up. So Pam is a rock star in the world, in my world of diabetes. She was also the reason we have these visuals outside as you walk in. I hope you appreciated some of the beautiful visuals on the pathway. If you didn't, please see them on the way out. And when I was struck walking into Pam's office that she had these gorgeous photographs on the wall. They're out there. And they're life and death. Mm-hmm. You know, and they look kind of the same. The life is creating cells that make insulin to help cure type 1 diabetes. And she's really, really, really important in that space in so many ways. And the others are about death or killing pancreatic cancer cells. And I guess you're a rock star in that world, too.
Oh, goodness.
So one thing that we share is we both got our inspiration to do what we do in the same place at about the same age. So I'm a little older, which is the Museum of Natural History in New York, which is a great place for inspiration.
Yes, and one of the things I wanted to say in reference to your comments is that when I was a young child and went there and looked at that brontosaurus the first time, what awed me was not that an animal this large could have existed. It was that this animal had roamed the earth. And that is why it was so important for me in wanting to be a scientist that it wasn't a replica. It was the real thing. And I know that we try to build replicas to bring art or science or anything to more people. But had that brontosaurus at that time just been made of plaster to recreate the original, it would not have had the same effect on me. It was an authenticity that they brought to me. And it was the same when I went to the mineral exhibits, that you could dig and there really is buried treasure. And this is it. Mm. So, you know, why do we stand in line for hours to see the real Pieta or the Statue of David? For me, it's not even as much about the beauty of it as to think of Michelangelo standing there and chipping away at that piece of marble or stone. So, and I think that's why live theater is so important. You could run Yoshimi one night and make a movie, and then everybody could see it. But why do we want to come here and see you do it? It's that connection to the authentic.
I'd like to respond to that. I feel like in the world of new media, one of the things that happens to a theater company all the time is people start talking to you about, why don't you make the jump over into, like, get online and film yourself and do a web series and disseminate the work kind of worldwide and virally. And what you're talking about always seems to me the limiting factor there of what we do requires an authentic, live, personal experience. Mm-hmm. And if you take the live moment out of it, the hands-on, the, like, emotionally connected, you're in the same room, and the communal experience of all of us in the same room, it's not theater anymore. It's something else.
Mm-hmm. And Pam, for me in the museum, it was the size. It's something that.
Well, it's true. Size matters. No, but you know, I think it's very true. It was so massive, and with the, when you think of us being children and being so excited, it was the huge dinosaur and the shiny minerals. And it's only later that you can appreciate things more subtle, like a cancer cell, right? That don't scream out at you.
So, Santi, maybe I'll bring you up next. So when Dr. Horgan did the first appendectomy through someone's mouth, he called his father, who's a surgeon in Argentina, and excitedly told his father what he had just done. To which your father said,
"Why?"
And you said,
"Because we could."
Because you said that. But it is amazing to be the first person in the world to imagine doing something and then to do it. And when I was talking with Santi about this, he said something that really struck me, that when you accomplish something like that, you not only change what's possible to do, but it revolutionizes how you think. And I thought that was very profound. So,
yeah, so the day that we did that operation, and Mark Talamini, who is the chairman of surgery, was also there in the operating room, we look back and we say, okay, what have we done, and now what? Because it really changed our thought process that things cannot be done, and really opened an entire new world of things that we are not doing, and start thinking totally out of the box. And I grew up with a dad who was a surgeon. He always taught me the bigger the scar, the better the surgeon. and that's how I grew up, you know. And I remember I was a kid and one of my friends had a big scar in the abdomen. I said, who did that? I mean, it was super big. He said, your dad. and I was shocked that day. And I think that we always minimize the impact of those things. And now that we can remove organs or an appendix or the gallbladder and be like a scientist, in and out, without nobody knowing that we did the operation, it changes. You know, when we see patients and we look at scars, we know what operation they had. And now they don't. So it's kind of, in a way, it's also art. But it's what you were saying earlier. You need to think totally out of the box. And if we continue thinking that an operation is done with a big incision, things will not change. But now technology really has impacted very much surgery and will continue to impact surgery.
So part of the art in what you do is not leaving a mark.
Not leaving a mark. Be as clean as we can.
Minimalist art.
But, you know, it's minimalist art. That's why my wife has a minimalist home.
So, Jerry, let me call up Jerry. Jerry Joyce is one of the very few people who was invited, I think maybe the only person invited by the Vatican to answer questions about the origins of life. And had an audience with the Pope as a part of that. And he, he'll tell you a little bit more, but just imagine creating molecules in a test tube that replicates, so they're essentially immortal, right? They'll live forever. And they're capable of evolving. That sounds a little bit like what God does.
No.
And so, well... Of course, that's what the BBC said about you, too, and a few others, but just imagining doing that. And by the way, there are some beautiful cryo-electromicrographs out there that show, and so maybe you could tell us about some of this this work you're doing.
Okay, but let's bring this down a little bit.
This work. Night of the Living Test Tubes or something.
Okay.
Vampire Test Tube.
These are just molecules, Dan. These are just molecules, and we're just biochemists. So I come from a land called Scripps, not Scripps Oceanographic, which you know about, not Scripps Memorial Hospital, not Scripps Clinic, the quiet Scripps, Scripps Research Institute. It's a biomedical research institute up on Torrey Pines Road, the largest, quietest biomedical research institute in the country, a private nonprofit biomedical research institute in the country. And we make molecular robots, I guess, that make more of themselves. That's what we do. I haven't seen Yoshimi yet. I'm really looking forward to it. And I was thinking about, why are robots so cool? I mean, they're not just machines. They're machines that take on, human characteristics. And, what makes a molecular robot cool is if it takes on biological characteristics. So what would be the most amazing thing you could imagine that a robot could do, whether it's a robotic machine or a robotic molecule? I think the most amazing thing, let's think about a robotic machine, would be if the robotic machine could make more robotic machines. And at the very end of the day, what it did was it took the program that it ran on to make robotic machines, and it copied that program and put it in the progeny robotic machines. And they did the same and the same and the same. And that's what we do with molecules. Now, that sounds, a little sinister or something. And, you know, it's not like I was summoned to the Vatican because there was anxiety. It was more just, it was the previous pope, you know, who was a little more open-minded to things like Darwinian evolution and origins of life. Although he was, when I said, my wife Nancy and I were there, and he said, so you're, where are you from now? And I said, La Jolla. And he said, Ohio, yes, I've been there. You know, so he, I guess, wasn't quite infallible. But but coming back to the coolest thing a robot can do would be to make more of itself. And as I say, that sounds a little scary, but then think about it. So what I find actually depressing are things that are not biological, things that don't reproduce and evolve in a Darwinian sense. You know, physics is kind of depressing, really, and there's even a... There's even a law about it. It's called the second law of thermodynamics. And it says, and it's never been violated because it's a law, after all, that over time, everything runs to an increasing state of randomness. The universe is going to run to ground. And there's a sort of inevitability to that, and it's depressing. And yet, standing in the face of that is hope, is an organization principle. And I think the play speaks to some of this, and I think life speaks to this in a grand way. It's this green uprising that's happened on our planet that's given, you know, beauty and variety to our planet. And as humble biochemists, that's what we seek to do with molecules. So we have built molecules that can reproduce themselves, that can copy their program and install it in their progeny molecules. And the progeny molecules do the same. And that goes on forever, and they evolve in a Darwinian sense in the test tube. I don't consider them alive. I mean, I just consider them molecules. But they give me hope, and they make me feel better about a universe that otherwise is forever running to ground.
Someone's going to do a movie about your
ass. Maybe a play.
Maybe a play. By the way, congratulations on $25 million that the Institute got today. I think for Dr. Yulevich, so that's a good day.
That's a good day for scripts, yes.
And so now I want to bring Tom Albright. So Tom, we were sitting in a meeting, and Tom is a soft-spoken gentleman, and was sort of letting us all babble about. And I just asked him a little question or two just at the very end, and when Tom opened his mouth, we all just got, you know, it's like the lights got brighter in the room, and we're all just drawn into these extraordinary research and ideas and how it really might affect space in the world, at least in the built world. So,
what Dan is talking about is some work I do with an organization called the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. I'll come back to that in a second. It bears on how an understanding of the brain might inform the design of human environments. I work at the Salk Institute, which many of you must know about. It's less than a mile down the road. It's an institution that's is renowned as much for the art of the building as it is for the extraordinary scientists who work there. I'm a neuroscientist, and a good fraction of the Salk Institute is neuroscience research, and I study the parts of the brain that are responsible for visual perception and visually guided behavior. Vision, of course, is our dominant sense. It's an extremely powerful sense. It's a sense that guides our actions from the time we wake up in the morning to the time we go to sleep at night. From an engineering point of view, we take it for granted. And I should have to say, the visual system is a lot more than your eye. This is a misperception that some people have. Our eyes create problems with our vision sometimes, and those are easily treated clinically. But there's a huge fraction of your brain that's devoted to the processing of visual information. And I'll come back to the sort of obvious connection between that and art, which I'll come back to in a minute. The visual system, from an engineering point of view, is a marvel. It works, it takes in a huge amount of information, it processes that information almost immediately, and rarely does it fail. There have been attempts to create artificial visual systems over the past several decades. Nothing comes anywhere close to the power of the human visual system. Now, as I said, there's an obvious, interesting, direct relationship between an understanding of visual perception and its neural basis, and appreciation and creation of art. In fact, some of the earliest empirical studies of how the visual system works were done by artists. Leonardo wrote extensively about visual perception and about creation of art. These are collected in something that's now called the Treatise on Painting, and he described a whole lot of interesting visual effects that a painter can create on a piece of canvas that lead to certain perceptual experiences. And it's possible to look at a piece of art if you have an understanding of vision. This is what I do, because I study the visual system. I look at things all the time, and I ask myself the question, why does it look the way it does? And you can do that with art. It's really an interesting experience, and you can sort of break it down. And I'll tell you just a brief story about how this can be done. I was a couple of years ago in Naples in southern Italy, and I was in the old part of Naples, downtown, a gritty part of the city, and I wandered into this tiny Baroque chapel. I think it was built in the 17th century, and in the middle of the chapel, in front of the altar, is this life-size sculpture of Jesus. He's supine on a pedestal, and he's under a shroud. So it's as though he's just been taken down off the cross, and he's lying there under this shroud. And it was sculpted out of marble. It was sculpted in the middle of the, I think in 1750 thereabouts, by a Neapolitan sculptor named Giuseppe San Martino. And it's remarkable. I mean, it's an extraordinary sculpture. It's also one of the creepiest things I've ever seen in my life. And the reason it's creepy is because it not only represents Jesus, it actually felt like there was a body under a shroud there. And I asked myself, why is this art around us as symbols for things in the real world? But it's rare when a piece of art just sort of completely takes you over like that. And you have the sense that it's actually a real thing in front of you, that it is sentient in some way, this object. This, you know, it's a sculpture of a body. And I dissected this, and I went through, and I could identify half a dozen, maybe eight different features of the sculpture. Some of them had to do with the materials. Some of them had to do with the shapes that the sculptor had created. Some of them had to do with the context, that is, the shroud. And you can pull this apart, and you can understand why this gives you this extraordinary illusion of reality, the sort of grand illusion that you get from this work of art. Now, you might say, well, this is a little bit like giving away the magic trick or unweaving the rainbow. And that's true, but on the other hand, it gives us a better appreciation of how we might create works of art that have that powerful impact on us, and also gives us a better understanding of what the brain does when we're experiencing these things.
And Tom, you work in a space that is an architectural marvel, and be one of the first such buildings. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and how you think it affects people, the collisions that happen in the building. This is the Salk Institute.
The Salk Institute, which, if you haven't seen it, it's right down the road. It's considered possibly the most important piece of architecture in the state of California. It's an extraordinary building, and to work in it is absolutely a delight. And those of us who work there feel that the building itself facilitates, and I'm not talking about, I mean, there are sort of practical aspects of that facilitation, like the pipes run in a certain way that makes them easy to access. But there's more to it than that. The building brings out something in people by virtue of the way it's designed. And this raises a larger question of how buildings are capable of doing that. And as I said at the outset, I belong to an organization called the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. The premise that this academy works by is that if we know enough about how the brain works, how it's organized, how it develops, we ought to be able to use that information to design better spaces for people to inhabit, people to work in, people to learn in, people to heal in. And it's a local organization. It was founded here in San Diego about a decade ago. There is a collection of very progressive architects who work here in San Diego and scientists who are part of the governing board. And we just had our first convention about 2 months ago. And what we do is try to understand, given what we know about the brain, try to understand why buildings like the Salk Institute have this impact on us. So we've all had these kinds of experiences. You walk into a building. The first time I went to the Cathedral of Chartres, it was extraordinary. Or I went to the Taj Mahal. And why do these things do this to us is the question. And we're beginning to understand, and you can see where vision comes, or understanding of the visual brain comes into this, because if we have that kind of appreciation for how the brain works, we can begin to understand why a piece of architecture has this effect, and moreover, take the next step, which is to advise an architect about how to build a better building. And there are lots of practical applications. For example, A big issue is how to build a better school for primary children, primary learning school. I went to a conference in Venice a couple months ago in which we discussed this as an effort on the part of the British government to identify schools that are better for learning. And so you can ask, well, you know, you put the windows in a certain place, you paint the walls a certain color, how do you do it? And so this is, again, just a conversation that we're starting to have now between scientists and artists in the form of architects.
I have to say, I think Salk was one of the first to think that scientists deserved beauty in as part of their work and could find inspiration in that. I know I almost didn't become a scientist because I thought I'd be working alone in a basement for the rest of my life with no windows. And I think that really was the case for a long time. And I'm now at the Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, which is a wonderful institute of basic science and moving things along translationally. And I think that it's this collaboration on the Mesa of really sharing and understanding that scientists need inspiration, and some of it actually comes from the beauty around us. And I think that didn't used to be the case.
So as the artistic director, there are a lot of skill sets that go into success. Maybe you could share with us some of those skill sets, because I think that there's some sharing of that and some of the ways that we're perhaps able to help each other.
Well, I mean, one of the great gifts of being artistic director is you get to invite great artists into your spaces, into your institution, and try to create an environment where they can do their most exciting work. And that kind of invitation process, the choosing, and then the supporting is sort of central to what I do. I also, I spent the afternoon over watching some of Yoshimi, and there's part of what I do also is try to figure out what people are thinking, particularly audiences. One of the things that happens in a preview process is you have this show up on stage, and then you've got this audience watching it, and the audience is the goldmine, right? Like, you've been watching the play happen in rehearsal room for 4, 6, 8 weeks, but the audience is the new factor, and what's happening inside their brains is the information you're trying to extract. And with comedies, it's easier, right? Because they'll laugh or they won't, which is pretty objective. With serious material, it can be really, really hard. You can pull them afterwards, but that's not really information you need. You want the like dynamic moment by moment. How are they receiving this play? What's working? What's not? You get really attuned to, in a really successful serious moment, there's a particular kind of quietness that happens in a space that's about everybody all the way focusing, and it's a higher level of focus that happens in kind of casual watching where everybody's invested suddenly. And I think some of it's cultural too. I did a comedy in Germany, and they don't laugh in Germany ever. There's no laughing. And I was sitting next to the artistic director who was German, and I said, "How do you know it's working?" And he said, "Listen for the murmur." And I leaned forward, and whenever a good laugh would happen, a good comedy line would happen, all the people would say, "That is very funny." You just had to listen for the everybody murmuring to each other. So, you know, I think one of the really satisfying things about running a theater is there is a real science to it, and there is a real art to the picking, and there is a real psychological, really almost kind of therapist aspect to it, and it really uses it's the roundest job I can imagine. You know, it really uses all the parts of left and right.
I wanted to say something about that. I think as a scientist also, our work almost doesn't exist until we present it to our peers. And in fact, we're looking for that same reaction. We have our own sense of what was important to do and whether we took a good approach, but it will actually be judged by others. Even though we do have a special moment when we know we might be the only person in the world who knows something or the only person in the world who's seen something, and yet it doesn't really exist until we share it and see how it's received by others.
That was one of the big aha moments for me. We had a pre-conversation about almost a week ago, was how much performing you guys do? Somebody said, are you nervous? And you guys started to talk about how many performances you had given, how many speeches, like how often you had been on a stage, and it was much more than me. So I was just into the performance aspect of science.
Naked
was,
without PowerPoint.
Exactly.
That's good.
Yeah.
So another thing that I was impressed upon me was the, again, this gestation of projects. So by the time you guys are presenting something, you've been working on it for, you know, decades in some cases, certainly many, many years. And so you have to sustain, obviously, interest. You make mistakes here and there, but you've got to keep it funded the whole time, too. And, you know, we've had careers in one type of, you know, funding environment, and I don't know that the current and the, you know, immediate future look the same as the last 5, 10, 15 years. So I'm wondering how that might affect chances you can take, projects you take on, the scope of building or contracting.
Well, Dan, and you know, the other challenge on top of that, and this is kind of Pam's point, is that it isn't just making the discovery. You want people to understand that discovery and react to it, okay? So, and it may take many years, a decade, to get to an important result and try to keep the funding going during that time and the personnel and so on. And yet, when you present that to an audience, they want to know what's new. What did you discover? What new data came in, and what new conclusions did you draw since I heard you speak last? Right? And so it's I think as Pam said, there's that aha moment, and that's a lot of fun. But then there's the communication part where it comes to others, and then there's the part. And I don't know how this plays in a theater audience. It's not just that they react or in Germany go but then what do they take from that, and how do they propagate that transfer of information from the discovery to the audience, to then how the audience influences other people. So we've got to maintain that sort of currency. At the same time, we've got to do these longitudinal research programs to actually keep moving forward.
You know, we started doing robotic surgery in, and we're talking about robots today, and we are doing robotic surgery to treat cancer in many areas.
Is a robot out there?
I think that there should be a robot somewhere, Da Vinci. and this started in 1999, and the goal was to develop a system that could be placed in Mars or in the Moon, and you could operate from here. And that can be done today. We can operate from San Diego and have the robot sitting in Japan or Argentina. But it took around 10 years of constant harassment to me and other peers that were doing robotic surgery from the medical community. Why are you doing it? The same question my dad asked me. Why? And we have a great idea, we develop great operations, but it took a long time, 10 years of frustrations and go into meetings and sometimes being attacked. Mm-hmm. Like it's happening now. If I tell you that we remove the gallbladder from the vagina, many of you are going to say, what? Why? No. And we have to go through that process of really making people understand that, you know, surgery today is also art, that we have to think out of the box if we want to evolve, and we want to change it, and it takes time. You do it one time, but then you have to repeat it, and every patient is a new canvas because every patient is different, reacts different. The anatomy is not the same. It's not what we see in books. It changes every day. The most happy moment for me when I go to the operating room is when I finish. Because I'm stressed too, you know, and because it's going to be different. It's a Pandora box, and that's true for art. It's always a Pandora box. A new play is a new audience, and you don't know how they are going to react. And that happens to us, believe it or not, in the operating room.
And what's the name of your robot?
Da Vinci. And the name of the company is Intuitive, so they have a lot in common. And you know, you were talking about buildings, and we just opened a year ago the biggest research and training facility in the world here, 3 or 4 blocks away. It's called the Center for the Future of Surgery. And it's nice to go there and work. It feels great to invent, to think out of the box. And I think that it's the combination of science and art. The building plays a very important role in us being able to go there every day.
You know, that idea of having to maintain the interest, the funding, everything for so many years, one of the issues that makes that so difficult is that everybody would agree right now, oh, yes, we want to fund someone to make new insulin cells from stem cells. But the reason that that was possible is because hundreds of us were studying pancreatic development over the last 40 years to figure out what factors and in what succession the normal pancreas is formed. And that's what would allow a company to now try these factors and create 5 months of gestation in 14 days in a dish. But somebody had to fund the 40 years of research to now get us to a point where we can think about translating it. And we have to keep that in mind. I hear a phrase all the time, patrons of the arts. I want to hear patrons of the science as much. Because very sadly, many of us have considered stopping what we're doing because we're spending about 80% of our time looking for funding instead of doing science. And that's really quite sad. Yeah. But I'll stop now.
No, but that is the new reality, and there's still these tremendous expectations to keep coming up with new ideas, and yet the capacity to generate them has really changed. Certainly has changed in clinical medicine, and again, the Playhouse has had an incredible run of success, and God willing, that continues. But again, we're able to live off that for a while longer, but that, you know, all the funding sources are a challenge. So we'll look up at the audience, at our funding sources. It's just past 6 o'clock. And so I don't know if you want to bring the lights up a little bit and let you in now officially on the conversation. I don't think I've got any cards in the meantime. Mm-hmm. So if people have a thought or a comment, just raise your hand. And Mia, we have someone. Oh, here we go. Can we bring a microphone down? Thank you. You shouldn't have to shout. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Joyce, I'm curious, do your molecules mutate?
They do that, yeah. Yeah, all by themselves. So, we don't take credit. You know, we're not the creators of these molecules. They just are immortal themselves. They reproduce. They mutate occasionally, not too much, because then the information gets lost, but just enough to kind of explore innovation. And those that do the best take over the population in a Darwinian sense.
So could they evolve past the design that you started with?
They do evolve. They evolve, you know, on our benches in the laboratory. Yeah, yeah.
That's why we're going to make that movie, or that play. And I'm sorry, we have trouble seeing you from here, so...
Thank you. This is a great talk. Just a quick question about medicine and technology. Do any of the doctors, like Dr. Horgan, think that technology in some ways can take away from your art of diagnosis, such as you know a patient has an appendicitis, but the insurance company wants you to prove it with a CT scan first?
That's a perfect example, and technology can take you in the wrong direction. There are many times where the CT scan says the patient has acute appendicitis, and we feel that it doesn't have acute appendicitis. And things are going to change. Technology today is part of the operating room, it's part of the hospitals. We have engineers constantly coming to the operating room to see how we can improve everyday things. But funding is an issue, and it's going to be more of an issue in the years to come. And that's something that we need more patrons, I guess.
Thank you.
But in the actual management, I can speak to this for a moment, in the actual management of an individual, technology can offer the illusion of taking over, but there is no substitute today for a thoughtful clinician and doing a proper evaluation.
You know, many times I get a phone call from a resident, and they say, these are the labs, this is the x-ray, this is the CT. And I drive from my house to the hospital to see how the patient looks. Because it's more important the way it looks than what the numbers say. So sometimes technology can guide you in the wrong direction.
That's very true. One thing, though, you know, now I have a daughter in medical training, and they call it evidence-based medicine. And I think really what they're trying to do with the technology is to say, when a doctor who's practiced for 40 years has an intuition about what's really wrong with the patient, what does that mean to have an intuition? To me, it's still just data, but it's small bits of data that have been threaded together over a lifetime. And so you can't pinpoint any one little datum, but if we can figure out what those are, we can help share them so that young doctors don't have to spend 40 years practicing before they understand. And that's what they're trying to do with a lot of the technology. How can we translate the, quote, intuition into the facts that are really behind how you knew by looking at someone?
Right. And yeah. And we are all about shortening learning curves.
Exactly.
Something that happens to me in the hospital, in the clinic, is patient will come in and will say, how many operations have you done? But that patient doesn't ask the pilot, how many flights have you done? because we know that technology was able to give him the learning curve very quickly. And I think that's where technology has a lot of future. Clearly, that's why we opened the Center for Physical Surgery to flatten those learning curves so we can bring more experience faster to everybody.
I don't know whether this has a corollary in science too, but I feel like one of the things that you do in theater is try to find a mix of the really experienced people who have done a lot of operations on stage and new voices, people who are bringing something sort of unexpected into the world and a voice that hasn't been heard. And often that's the word often used in theater is emerging voices, and that kind of mix. Trying to give enough permission, resources, and voice and stage to the sort of emerging voices as well as the master craftsmen.
Yeah, I think we're also talking about risk. I mean, the question kind of triggered that. So I would be so scared to do what you do because...
And I am.
And that's why the best part is the end of the procedure, because the risk period is ended, you know. And then in the playhouse, I mean, you know, it's always a balance, I would think, between really laying an egg but putting yourself on the edge. In science, I feel like, although because of funding situations and the need to perform, you know, we are more risk-averse than we used to be, we really need to be able to fail in science. I mean, you know, I like to say to my students, and they don't like to hear this, that the best experiment is one that has a 50-50 chance of succeeding, because you get the most information that way. You're flipping the coin, you know. But you can't do a 50-50, and I don't think the playoffs can do it.
They will not approve that.
But what we can develop as well as funders is actually an audience that has a high risk tolerance, right? Like, that's over time. If you do the kind of work, you thank you for being here. but developing an audience that actually can tolerate a 50-50 experience, as opposed to one that has the Siskel and Ebert problem of thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah.
I love how funny you guys are. I want to do like a tour of stand-up science with these guys. like making audiences laugh.
Hi. Over here, I have a question on this side. You're right. I was wondering if any of you could talk about where does creativity come from? And my experience, often you were talking about experience and youth, but I think often it's bringing people from completely different backgrounds and experiences to work on the same problem, sort of orthogonal thinking as my neighbor here was mentioning. So I'm wondering how in your world this has played out.
Well, you know, we meet every Saturday for breakfast for 3 hours just to brainstorm how to change things. And we have people from Japan, Colombia, France, China, and we say, okay, we have this problem. How do we do it different? How do we change? And we let people brainstorm, and younger generations have much more capacity to brainstorm than me, that's for sure. but once we brainstorm, we develop the project and then we go for it. But we do have that freedom of sitting down, kind of what Steve Jobs did and, you know, and people like Google do every day, or where you have brainstorming days and bring new ideas and try try to change. I mean, if I tell you that diabetes can be cured with surgery today, you're going to say, no way. And that came from brainstorming ideas, that why we have diabetes and can surgery change it. And
so about 12 years ago, I brought one of the bariatric surgeons, the early ones here in San Diego, to an endocrinology meeting in Toronto, so he would present his data on exactly what you said. So there were 5,000 people in that audience ready to just string them up then and there, because he was telling them that they were irrelevant and he could do it with the knife. So you can face some pretty hostile crowds on your way to proving your point.
This is what happens in science as well. Neuroscience is a good example of this. This is a field that's really evolved over the past 50 years or so it came into being. And it's vastly interdisciplinary. It includes biology, traditional biology, chemistry, physics, math, philosophy, psychology, cognitive science. And all of these people are trying to understand the brain from different perspectives. And it's given the field an enormous amount of power. Power and creativity that wouldn't have come about otherwise if it had merged simply through one of those disciplines alone.
I think the biggest leaps are interdisciplinary, and it's having someone come look with totally new eyes at a problem that leads to that kind of innovation. What kind of technical people do you enlist to do this play?
I agree. It's very interdisciplinary. We had an interesting moment on Yoshimi. We have this great machine. It's a computer-guided lathe. And you have to put in, you give it a kind of form in the computer program, and it'll carve it out, that form out for you. And we've had a problem for several years with it of you can do that on styrofoam, which is very fast but incredibly toxic to the people working on it. You can do it in wood, which is safe but very, very, very slow. And we were talking about this problem, and actually a board member said, oh, you know, my husband has this new material that they're using in housing and a little bit in film now that's made from castor oil, but it's very moldable. We got some of it, and it's incredibly fast and incredibly safe. And it was the interdisciplinary thing, that something that came from construction turns out to be very useful, and it's what we made all of the robot forms out of for Yoshimi. So I second the interdisciplinary is the key so often.
As public citizens, we're looking for return on the ways in which we fund research. And one of the things I've noticed is there's a lot of people asking for ways to continue the research in so many different areas. And it's almost like making a lot of small bets, as opposed to a few big bets that might actually create a certain return on investment that people can see more readily. Certainly, every discipline can show work that has improved in the last 3 years, but is there a way that we could consider fewer, bigger bets that would pay off in such a grand way that everyone would take notice?
Basically, only you on the stage would be getting the funding. That's the question.
I second that.
I want to comment. It's a very important question. You know, picking who can move the ball the most. But
they did this in physics, and now physics is too expensive. I mean, they focused on grand projects like building these superconducting supercolliders, and they're now too expensive to build. And so a lot of physicists are actually out of business. The Science at the Salk Institute, which is what I can speak to, is mostly relatively small labs. These are labs that are focused on big problems, but they're not. There is a genre of science which is sort of empires, a whole lot of people that are focused on a single problem. And we found at the Salk Institute that model just isn't optimal for us.
So maybe the Genome Project is a good example of something that took that kind of resources and has changed the research many are able to do now, because we have the entire code of the human genome. But it's whether or not we should focus on just that kind of science. That's the question.
Okay, I'm going to go all Darwinian on you here, because I think there is a Darwinian answer to your question, which is, you know, you play it based on fitness. So you don't want everything to survive, because then everything survives and the landscape is full of losers. But you don't want the one winner to win, because suppose we put the big bet on the dinosaurs, as inspiring as they were to you guys, you know. Because if the environment or knowledge as it accumulates changes in some dramatic, say, asteroid-like way, then that was a dumb bet. So it's actually a mix of that, and life on Earth does that. It bets on both the big and the small, but it bets in proportion to fitness. The more fit a given play being a species, is, the more progeny it produces, the more it gets to play into future generations. And how do we do that in science? We have something called peer review. So we don't have some person on high make the decisions, and we don't let everybody practice at equal opportunity, no matter how good or bad they are. We actually trust tough standards of peer review to score the fitness of individual ideas and projects, and then bet accordingly. And that lets big bets and small bets be played in proportion to their fitness. So there's my Darwinian answer for you.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Speaking of fitness, a lot of what you have been talking about is the... I'm over here in the middle.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we should do this. Yeah.
Sure. A lot of what you've been talking about is the care and treatment after the fact. And once people get sick, they need surgery and all kinds of things, and, of course, the diabetic problem. But the biggest problem that we're facing as a country, and we've spread it to the rest of the world, is we have an unhealthy population. And it's diet, it's lack of exercise, it's stress, it's all of these things. And I'd like to just have the panel talk about, how do you think technology and science and art can help people be healthier and take care of themselves? Because we have a train wreck coming with an aging population and a young population that's very, very sick.
Well, Chris, that's how evolved we are on that. This is a question that gets discussed in many fora. This was meant to be a scientific forum, but if you think of the impact of entertainment and media on especially the you know, adolescent and the growing mind, it is remarkable that we haven't seemed to be able to move that dial very much in that, you know, that adolescence message. When they're most open, most and kids, we can't seem to reach them then. I know that, for example, the Playhouse does a huge amount. Is it 40,000 people, young people touched?
A huge education department, yeah.
And so
outreach.
Part of what attracted me actually to working with the Playhouse is really questions such as yours. And how do you learn to help program people into healthier living and make it fun? David Sedaris actually used the word diabetes as a joke. He was going to put it in the title of one of his books to kill the book. But what do you think? I mean, we're really not there in being able to answer that question.
No, we're not. I mean, I was interested in the idea of sort of Darwinianism as it comes to art, because I think that there's also entertainment, which is related to art, which is absolutely survival of the fittest, right? Like Hollywood and TMZ and Entertainment Tonight will take care of like the most popular possible kind of art.
That's called a virus.
Maybe it's viral, yeah. And I think there's Wall as a maker of arts, one of the things you really, really want is impact and an audience. I think there's also something to be said for intensity of the experience. Like there's as much value in a really intense experience for a 4-week run in a 100-seat theater, to me, as there is in a truly widely popular, pretty satisfying experience. Like, and I think the insisting on the intense experience for the people it's really going to matter to is one of the functions of art too. Can art heal? A question about like I sometimes think it can. I mean, I get in my really grandiose moments. I sometimes think that that nothing is more important than a real engagement with the creative part of the human spirit. I don't know that it's going to take away diabetes or, you know, heal the youth of America, but I think it's a part of a full life. And without it, I think it's easier to be a sick society, and with it, it's easier to be well.
But you know, to what you were saying, it has to do with a cultural change. We all know that obesity is not good. We all know that it leads to cancer, it leads to diabetes, it leads to hypertension. People that are overweight have less life expectancy than the ones that are not. And obesity keeps growing, even though we know all those things. And many of us are doing new operations that will be able to reduce obesity prophylactically to stop hypertension, diabetes, cancer, etc. So we are creating now new operations that can be performed before you have diabetes, because we know very well that most of our patients have diabetes because they're overweight.
But obviously we're not totally rational beings, or this wouldn't even be an issue, right? We just aren't. Mm-hmm. And back to the point about how to fund and what to fund, it's partly that we know that we don't know. And that's one reason to fund a lot of science, different disparate ideas, and a lot of art, disparate ideas, because we want to find the thing. If we knew what we were looking for, it wouldn't be research. And so we want to make sure we keep that door open artistically and scientifically also for new things nobody did think of to put a bet on, so that we can all be moved by that. But I have a question for my colleagues about what drives us, because for me, I think there is a downside to passion, that it keeps you extremely busy. And that if you spend all your time looking in a microscope or a telescope, you can miss what's right in front of you. And for me, it's very clearly a desire to leave something good when I'm gone. So I did two near-perfect biological experiments, and one of them's in the audience. But I wonder, for the rest of you also, if it's really got to do with mortality. And I envy people sometimes who think, just be. Whatever you are, it's good enough. And I think for most of us, what we are isn't good enough, and what we have done isn't good enough. And it's a passion, but it's a pressure.
Theater is the most temporary art form, so if you want to be in it to leave something behind, it's the wrong place to be. It comes and it goes. But trying to live your life and explore the world in the most vibrant way possible, and trying to be a part of a community that together explores and feels as intensely as they possibly can, is why I'm in it.
I just couldn't do anything else. This is a program to do exactly what I'm doing. We only have a few minutes left, please.
2015 is as Des mentioned, is the 50th anniversary of the founding of the National Endowment for the Arts. It's also the 100th anniversary of a century of creativity here in San Diego. I, as an audience member, certainly appreciate this type of a venue. I was just wondering whether or not there might be a way to go and get funding for the National Endowment of the Arts and also the city of San Diego, with their increase of the penny for the arts, to put on a series of vignettes kind of celebrating the creativity over the last century and including now in 2015 or leading up to that. Something to consider.
Would you write the grant?
I'd be happy to work on it.
It'd also be something to have a photograph of what this mesa looked like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
It's quite different.
I just want to thank you all. As each one of you spoke, my brain was worrying. And then the next person spoke, and it was worrying. So I just want to thank you all, because you really have created a lot of thought. But one of the speakers, the one, I just really wonder, it really is a marriage of art and science and engineering when we talk about architecture and a building and how it affects the people inside. I wonder if you could give us a few examples of what you mean, how your building has helped the people inside.
If people have asked me this for years, and it's a common question for people who work at the Salk Institute, they're simple things. Having lots of natural daylight makes a difference in your sort of your mental processes. Having high ceilings reduces your stress level and so forth. But those are superficial. There are presumably deeper facets of that environment that have an impact over the way we work and the way we think. Is a practical issue, which is the Salk Institute. If you've been there, you may know that each floor is 16,000 square feet of undifferentiated space. That is, these are concrete floors that are suspended from the outside. And that means that there are no walls between laboratories. And people wander from one place to another. And that gets to a question that was raised earlier about the creative process and the role of interdisciplinary interactions in the creative process. And that building, just by virtue of that feature of its design, facilitates those kinds of social interactions that lead to novel science. That's not, again, I'm part of this organization, the Academy of Neuroscience and Architecture. That's not an effect that's directly on your brain that causes you to think differently. It just happens that you bump into people who might cause you to think differently.
You know, in what we do in surgery, the mood has a lot to do with the outcome. A patient that comes into with a great attitude is going to recuperate quicker. And if you go back 50 years to see how the hospitals were, they were all gray, black, and with smell. They smell hospital. And today, the hospitals are bright. They don't look like lobbies. The hospitals, most of them, the new ones, look like hotels or homes. And the goal is that you come in and you have a great attitude. It doesn't matter what your problem is. And that really changes the outcome of what we do in the hospital. It really does.
Right. Yeah, right here. I was thinking about the youth as well, in regards to their apparently declining interest in science and maybe the arts as well. We have trouble keeping our kids motivated with their piano lessons, for example. I'm wondering if this kind of discussion, this kind of merger between science and the art, would build their interest. Like if it were to happen in the classroom, obviously at a lower level. But what do you think? How can we get them more interested in these subjects?
Well, that actually gives me a chance to say, for those who couldn't be here tonight, it's being filmed by UCSD TV, so it's on UCSD TV starting within about a week or so, and it'll be up on YouTube, so it's going to live forever, and so that's probably where the kids are going to end up seeing this, if at all. But
it's a really good point.
Yeah.
I think science can be explained on any level. Exciting science. We have children come to the labs to get inspired. We go to schools and talk to them. And it's just getting rid of the lingo. And I wouldn't understand what an engineer is saying if they use the lingo of their trade. But if I tell you that I'm interested in a bag that will hide cells from the immune system, a four-year-old can understand that. And we want to put that bag in your body so that those cells will survive and your body won't fight them. And I think you're right. I think we could be doing a better job. We know how to bring art to children. I mean, we don't fund it well enough, but we know how to do it. But you're really right. We could do a better job with science of showing them what's exciting, because if they saw stem cells beating in a dish, they might all want to be scientists.
And, of course, there is the Museum of Natural History in New York at a certain age.
Take them to New York.
Take them to New York.
Well, we have our own museum, too, which is also very nice.
Yeah, we do.
But we don't have dinosaurs.
So we have time for one more question. There's been a question up here for a while. Maybe I've missed it. We have to stop shortly. I apologize. Okay, please. Who has a mic? Yeah.
I'm here.
Okay. Go for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, everybody can hear me, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, no, no difficulty. Yep. It's terrible that this is the last to go. I can't be covered. Oh, thank you. I'm kind of curious because the conversation has been absolutely fascinating, and the idea of art and science. But it also implies artists and scientists. And what are the analogies there? We've heard much always about the starving artist. Are there many starving scientists?
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
But I'd like to answer in one way that it's very similar. You can be an artist or a scientist because you see something new. You have a perspective that hasn't been seen before. Or because you've come up with a way to prove something or to express something, right? Even something that was already known, but not shown in a novel light. But a masterpiece only comes when you put the two together. And that, in that way, scientists and artists are exactly alike, I think.
Yes, I get it. My question is it's much more, I guess, related to psychology than anything else, because there's a very famous remark that Bert Lahr made one night when he finished the performance, and he came into the dressing room and he said, "I died out there tonight." Oh, you know that?
No, I like it.
No, I thought maybe you knew it from experience.
We do know it from experience.
Yes, that's what I mean. I mean, is it the same? Is there that same kind of passion, discouragement, devastation? I mean, that's devastation. I died out there tonight.
Yes.
It is, you know, when we do a new operation that was not done or is your first one, my wife is there. She can tell you. I go home and I'm dead.
Dead. Good.
Because of the stress level, because you are dealing with a life. It needs to do well. And you, many times we say we died in the operating room today, or it took me 3 years of my life.
Yeah.
So the analogy is complete.
You should talk to my graduate students.
Yes.
Failure is something familiar to all.
Yes.
And it hurts.
Yes.
But the more that you explore and you don't have a roadmap, the more you are likely to have those moments where something was an utter disaster.
And for us, is when a patient doesn't do well. You died every minute.
Yeah.
Because you are so attached, right?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We have a thing sometimes when things are going really, really badly in technical rehearsal, people will like, "Oh, it's the end of the world, it's so awful." And somebody will often say, "Well, you know, it's not brain surgery." Nobody.
And of course, that's not rocket science.
Exactly.
Anyway, I promise that my only job tonight was to end us more or less on time, and so we have to do it. I want to thank our panelists for the amazing work that you do, the amazing work tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.